Up next, we're going to talk about the ancient structures like Stonehenge, pyramids, but what do they reveal about science and the cosmos? Richard Heath joins us, and we're going to go live to Wales with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Richard Heath with us, a developmental engineer with degrees in system science and computer-aided design. His interest in megalithic astronomy and meteorology has resulted in four books, including Sacred Number and Origins of Civilization. He lives near Cardigan, Wales, and welcome to Coast, Richard Heath. Hello, Richard. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, George.
Looking forward to this. Tell me a little bit more about how you got interested in the ancient structures.
Right. Well, we live in a land in England with lots of things like you have your large earthworks and so on, but we have these stone circles. And when you try analyzing the stone circles by measuring them and looking at angles, you discover that one of their prime functions was to time the periods between events on the horizon with the sun, the moon, and other things happening in the sky. And so by doing that, this brings you into contact with the world of number. And you find out then that there are certain coincidences of number and certain numbers that are sacred numbers. Well, they became sacred numbers because they were originally seen as being part of a network of relationships that exists in the sky, which probably gave us the idea of that the heaven was in the sky.
These ancients possessed an innate ability to have incredible knowledge. How did they pick this up? I mean, they didn't have the kind of technology we have today.
Yeah. Well, we know that as long as 10,000 years or more ago, they were making all sorts of numerical discoveries, like they were counting things, making calendars, and playing with designs, geometrical designs, and making art. And they seemed very intelligent, and particularly in the area of visualizing what was happening in the world. Like we perhaps aren't today, because we're so involved in everyday things that we haven't developed that we haven't got that form of perception as strongly. So they turned the idea of counting the moon to find out it was useful to know when there was going to be a light moon, and so particularly every 2 months. You find that exactly 59 days between the full moons, and that's the beginning of a kind of number that's starting to emerge. So if you can count or write it down, put lines, you know, just vertical lines on a tally.
Their accuracy was incredible, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, what they did was, and you use the word meteorology, but the word is metrology, which is the science of measure. In order for us to know anything, we have to measure it first. If we're going to know it in the full sense of that, you know, we have to know it in the sense of knowing a fact. And so to know the facts of these periods of time, first of all, they counted the periods of time, but then they had a brilliant idea of using a constant unit between the lines of the tally. And in fact, it sounds unbelievable, but in Karnak, there's a monument, and we've seen it repeated in other monuments now, where one day equaled one inch, and it's the same inch that we use today. And this has caused a lot of problems in the world of archaeology, because exactness is not expected, and exactly the same units as we have today is not expected, because then there has to have been a transmission, some kind of continuous transmission over 5,000 to 7,000 years of units of measure to the present day.
When they were doing all their calculations, was...
Well, they didn't do calculations, George. And what I'm saying is that they stored numbers in length. So that when they counted, you know, the length of a solar year or a lunar year, which is 12 lunar months, they found that, well, over 3 years, they get this figure, and they then have a count of the solar years, which is between, say, the equinox points or solstice points of the year, and those two things are two lines that are of a different length, but they're made up of exact inches, which count for days. And so when you raise the longer one, which is the solar year, over the lunar year, you get a very essential geometrical figure, which is a triangle with a right angle, like we have in trigonometry today. And in that, you can see some interesting numerical relationships which relate the sun and the moon, which is a very difficult thing to relate the sun to the moon, because the moon is highly irregular with respect to the sun. But there is an underlying pattern which actually belongs to a 19-year period in which there are a fixed number of, an exact number of lunar months in 19 years called the Metonic period. And from this flowed a tremendous knowledge through this geometrical use of fixed lengths that they'd created. So the metrology that they invented at that point became something through which knowledge was transmitted that modern science never could understand, because it was doing things in a much more sophisticated way. And so what I'm going to be talking to you about tonight is about a type of knowledge that we just can't see using the ideas of modern science and the way that we're set up to do science today.
Were they better than we were when it came to this?
Well, if you consider the meaning, and I might come to that, of course, the meaning of what's revealed by their science, then in some ways it's superior. Because whereas our science has taken everything to the limits of the universe and seen majestic wonders, you know, and made great discoveries about general laws, they understood something about the Earth and the time periods around the Earth in a way that's similar to what we say called the geocentric view of the world, which people had before. In the last 1,000 years, you know, Copernicus and the developments of our vision of the sun being the center of the world. But in another sense, there's an equally valid view that they recovered, which is that the time around the Earth, which is only seen from the Earth, has very special time relationships to do with number. And this is why I proposed that there is a kind of musical instrument involved in the time surrounding the Earth that would not be seen from Mars.
Explain that.
Well, when a planet, for instance, goes round and we are going round, we see a different length of period of the recurrence of things to do with that planet. We see a different length than the period of it going around the sun. So what we call the orbits of the planets, they get longer as you get further out from the sun. In this case, there's a relationship between how much longer the planet takes to repeat its phenomena after the solar year. That's seen from our orbit. And so it's translated into a different world of time. And that's the world we've been brought up in. That's how life was created here. And then things these relationships have come into focus over time as the moon settled in after its creation. Because the moon was created by a collision in the early solar system, And it has taken time for these conditions to arise. And those are the conditions that have been occurring in the last 200,000 to 70,000 years.
What amazes you, Richard, when you look at the ancient origins of the ancient world, what fascinates you the most?
Well, at the moment, I'd say that it's the inherent ability of people we call primitive to have come to a very sophisticated view of the world, quite naturally, and then for it to have been transmitted and have created our what we call history, our ancient history, like in the ancient Near East and in other places like India and also the historical paths of the Native Americans and the Mayans and so forth, that this knowledge was transmitted to all of these different areas and became part of our well-known stories, but in a secret code. And so for the last 5 or 6 years, I was working with an elderly American professor of music who had studied Plato and had recovered some of the techniques for understanding the musicality of the ancient world through harmonic numbers that are embedded inside their texts.
What did they use the music for?
Well, originally, the first perception is almost certainly that the planets are gods. And this is even explicitly stated, of course, by Hesiod in ancient Greece, in the myths of Zeus and Saturn. And generally speaking, in the Babylonian times, they thought that the planets were gods. And the explanation of this has come out through my working with this gentleman called Ernest G. MacLean, who yesterday would be 100 years old. And he lived a life in New York as a professor of music. And he had a very wide-ranging set of friends. And when I joined those, I found the key to being able to translate musical harmonies that I had found 15 years before, putting them in the form of the ancient world. And then it became clear that possibly the ancient world was preserving a doctrine that originally had arisen with megalithic astronomy. And so it tied the two areas together for me.
By doing this, of course, they possessed some incredible innate abilities that we don't have today. If we had put, let's say, engineers or architects in that era, could they have done what was built in those days? Stonehenge, the pyramids?
Certainly, it's very difficult to think of that. Of course, we take building in a different way, but architects have had a good history of looking at megalithic monuments, I think a few of them anyway, but and also astronomers have. But the trouble is with all of our specialisms, in the modern world, there becomes a limit as to what you can really get involved with because, you know, you're talking about an alien world if you truly go into the mind of the people who conceived this system of their thought, which was religious, and then before that, astronomical.
Richard, since the beginning of time, of course, we have wondered how the pyramids were built. Do you have any idea?
Well, using metrology being able to do very accurate surveys, and using simple techniques that allowed you to do what would be very difficult if you use modern machinery. I mean, the only one I heard about recently was that they created a large square area of a hole in the ground and put water in it, and therefore they got a perfect level for which to build
the
pyramid.
Yeah, I had heard that too.
The other thing is that it's also a model of the Earth, in fact. But again, these things are not accepted today because metrology itself isn't. But the height of the pyramid, if it didn't have the bit missing at the top, would equal the radius of the mean Earth if it was a perfect sphere, whereas the actual height represents the polar radius.
And how would they know that?
Well, this is the problem. I think after the astronomy, because of their ability to do long length alignments to accurately to planetary events and so on, they developed skills. And with the geometrical knowledge, they were able to measure but probably in some clever way, rather than exactly how we would do it today, to measure the what's called the geoid of the planet. And they came up with a very accurate model, which was based, in a sense, around the mean Earth. And the equator, they knew the size of the equator by inferring it from another latitude. You can do that sort of thing. And then they measured certain key latitudes. And I believe that the sequence went that the astronomy was largely done on the Atlantic coast. And then it came into contact with Egypt, and the Egyptians took it much further developed, of course, all of their mathematics, which started to transfer into being like the mathematics that you see with the Greeks. It's sort of slowly things were added, and in the ancient Near East, they were in contact with them. And so calculation and usage of numbers took over from a lot of the previous levels of method. So that although geometry became a subject, and as it's still taught today in our schools, it was different. It wasn't analytical geometry. It was like a practical geometry.
And was there any extraterrestrial help here, Richard?
Well, you know, one of my criteria was to try to stay within the bounds of things that were available to know as actual things, rather than, you know, obviously I'm not ignorant about all these sorts of theories, and but I instinctively go away from power supplies in the pyramids, for instance, and this makes me in some way no fun, but I'm saying that it's a method because I believe you can say that the counting of time and the creation of geometrical structures led to really interesting facts about the astronomy, which we'll come on to do with the musical image, because my previous books were largely to do with things like megalithic astronomy and the role of sacred numbers in society, you know, in the past. But my latest book, which was Harmonic Origins of the World, does a presentation, really, of the whole story from this megalithic period through the ancient world and the texts, and a bit of background material about how much they knew in the ancient world about tuning, and then comes to, you know, various religious speculations that appear to be in the texts of the New Testament, the Old Testament. The Bible is particularly important, and so on. So I don't know where we are on that answer, but...
Well, I guess somewhere along the line with this kind of knowledge, there's got to be a God factor somewhere, isn't there? Hold on, Richard. We'll be back in a moment with more on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to go to open lines at least this half hour, so you've got the numbers. Make the call, whatever on your mind. Things are going all over the world. We seem to have lost our connection with Richard Heath, who is in Wales. He is gone. So open lines it is, folks. Make the phone call, and we'll get to that in a second on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're going to have open lines for you this half hour and maybe next hour. We'll see what happens. Let me give you the numbers again. West of the Rockies, 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line, 818-501-4721. The wild card line, of course, is 818-501-4109. and the international number, of course. You can use 818-817-0021 to get on that line. 818-817-0021. And Skype is open at George 97313. Lots going on these days. Let's go to the phones. Doug is in New Jersey. Welcome to the program. Hi, Doug. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you tonight,
George? I'm great. How about you?
I'm doing quite well. Thanks for asking.
Good.
Yeah, my question was more or less an observation. I live here in Jersey. We have across the nation, this opium epidemic,
oh,
with the heroin and everything.
It's horrible.
I was trying to have a conversation with somebody the other day, and I was telling them, I said, doesn't it seem that the last time this had happened with the heroin epidemic was during the Vietnam War, and we were getting all of this heroin that was being shipped over here, or maybe it was being brought here by us to help support the the war machine or whatever. But now that we're out here, we're Pakistan, and all of these places where that's what they do. They grow. They grow the opium to go ahead and they grow the poppies to make the opium, the heroin, and everything else that's coming over here. And I honestly believe that the government is in on it too, and it's like the dumbing down of America. We're wiping out an entire generation that wouldn't be able to fight a battle at war, wouldn't be able to go ahead and take care of the, your day-to-day affairs and everything. And I mean, it's really bad around here. I've seen everything from teenagers in the newspaper every day overdosing to people in their 60s and 70s. It's ridiculous. And I just wanted to know what your thought was about that.
Well, first of all, we're told that there are U.S. troops guarding the poppy fields in Afghanistan. They're out there protecting those fields.
I would think that it would be much more advice for us as a country to go ahead and drop one of these bombs on one of these poppy fields instead of a little mud hut that doesn't, nothing happens afterwards.
You would think, except I think that we're controlling those poppy fields. I think they're ours. The Taliban had them almost extinguished. And when we went into Afghanistan in 2003, and 2001, actually, right after 9/11, poppy fields began to flourish again. And, we're behind it. It's a covert operation, and it's disgusting.
It truly is. And then we go ahead and spend thousands and thousands of dollars for medical care for these people who are trying to get sober. And It's just going on and on and on, pushing up all of the economical everything from the hospitals to the insurances to the law enforcement trying to keep up with it, and it's definitely something that has to be taken care of. And I think we should start addressing these programs more here at home and stop worrying so much about these other countries that have problems that we're donating money to and everything that we don't even have to donate, but yet every year, there's close to a couple $1 billion that we're sending to a country that got hit by a tidal wave or wiped out by some kind of a plague or whatever. And I don't believe any of these people have ever helped us. I can't remember a time when we had a natural disaster here in the United States where they sent people here to help us. We sent the Red Cross, we send the Salvation Army, everybody all over the world to help out, donate money.
We sure do. Hey, Doug, thanks. Appreciate that. And you're right about the heroin epidemic, basically. I think it's passing in this country cocaine use, and it's even deadlier. Next up, let's go to Jeremy, first-time caller in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, my friend.
I'm very excited to be on your show. I just had a story that I wanted to share with you. And I've heard you guys talk about the shadow guy.
The shadow people.
Well, it's more or less the guy with the hat I don't know how to explain it. But one night I was sleeping and I kind of woke up out of my sleep like, when you feel somebody staring at you. And I woke up. And I seen that figure at the end of my bed, and as soon as I was trying to make out his face, it kind of jumped at me, and like it felt like I was getting sucked through the bed, kind of thing. You get the ringing in the ears.
Yep.
And I was listening to your show, and I've heard you guys talk about this guy, and it kind of made my hair stand up, because it's like almost everything that I've heard you guys talk about has happened. And I was just wondering your thoughts about that, and see what you had to say.
Well, let me tell you, that it is very scary, the shadow people. It's a story that a number of experts, including Heidi Hollis, have brought to us. And I think it's something that is coming from another dimension. It somehow leaks through into our dimension, and then it can't find its way back or something like that. But it's very weird. They have these top hats, these tall hats, and they're scary. I mean, my gosh, can you imagine seeing a shadow of a person like that going across your room? Not good. At all. Next up, Annie in Alabama is with us. Welcome to the show. Hi, Annie.
Hello, George. Somebody way down the hall's got the radio on some other station. I hope you can't hear it.
I can't hear it, but knock on that door and change it to our station.
You know, I'm calling about Jahi McMath and other people who have been pronounced dead wrongfully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was pronounced dead, and they gave her a death certificate in the state of California.
Yep.
Her mother said, no, my baby's not dead. Her mother fought it and won and took her to another state, and that girl has grown. She's breathing, and she's got a heartbeat. And I think that there's something wrong, very, very wrong going on. This is murder.
What do you think's happening?
They're pronouncing people dead that are not dead.
How could they miss this stuff?
They don't miss it. They're just lying. She's got a heartbeat. She had a heartbeat. You can't pronounce somebody dead with a heartbeat in any vital signs. You've got to have all four vital signs completely gone. And
well, other than making a mistake, Annie, what's their motive? What do you think?
Money?
Money.
They're just criminals. It's just a money motive.
Where are they going to make their money on a dead body?
Transplants.
Oh, body parts and stuff?
Yes.
Even from babies?
Yes.
Huh. Well, I know they're doing that in China. Maybe they're doing it here, too. Who knows? Let's go to San Diego. Joe's with us. Welcome, Joseph.
Hey, Nori. George Nori.
Yes, sir.
You always ask your... Sometimes I hear you all. You ask your guests, do you think there's God? Because it's so structured. The universe is so structured and perfect. It couldn't have happened by chance.
Right.
Well, then I would suggest to you that you somehow somehow or other read the Vedic literature from India, or knows, or get a hold of somebody that does. Because I've studied the Vedas. I've studied all world religions. And I've had a few things happen in my life. You know, I was in a tsunami. Other things have happened in my life. But
were you in that Indonesian one where the 200,000 people died?
No, I was in the Pacifica. I was in the south of San Francisco in Pacifica in 1964.
Ah.
Alaskan tsunami hit and came two streets from my house. I didn't get my feet wet, but I was in the, you know, I was in the city. It was a tsunami. But the Vedic literature is so scientific. And it can be proven if you actually do the experiment of practicing and the science of yoga, you can see within your heart the Atma, the soul. Paramatma means great soul or God, who travels with us from body to body to guide us. But anyway, the Vedas will tell us everything. The Veda, and I don't understand. Everyone thinks that India is so backwards.
Oh, but they're far from backward. They're probably more advanced when it comes to spirituality than anybody.
But anyway, good luck with your search, and we're all searching, and all I can say is I'm not my body, and no matter what I can do to my body, whether it's liquor, pot, whatever, to stimulate the senses, it's not me. So what's the point? The point is to give up all material desires, re-enter heaven where there's no material desires, and until we become free from all material desires, we'll come back again and again and again.
And Joe, let me ask you, though, this sure. order that I've talked about on the show, this order
right.
throughout the universe, what do you think is doing this?
The order?
Yeah, the structure and everything else.
It's God. It's all. It's,
yeah,
it's God.
Absolutely.
It's all described in the Vedic literature, if you know the right source, and it's not from a. Some yogis teach that the light from the spiritual realm, the Brahman, is what we are. We're not God. We're little pieces of God, like from the ocean. God is God, and we are spiritual, and we're part of that. We're not God. We're part of God. God made us. We have free will, and at some point in the spiritual realm, we decided maybe there's a better place, and immediately he sent us here. And until we realize that we're not this body, until we realize that we're not these material desires, and give them up. And at the time of death, karma and desire will propel you into your next body. And there's 3,400,000 species of life in the cosmic manifestation. It's all described in the Vedic literature.
All right.
It's very simple.
It's good job, though, Joe. Good job. And I've got to tell you, I have said on this program, as you pointed out, that there's too much order and structure in the universe for this to be random without any kind of involvement of some kind of intelligence. Now, we talk about the God factor. I mean, nobody really knows what or who God is. Nobody knows that. You know, religious organizations will tell you something in one direction, but the bottom line is we don't know. But I can say that there's got to be something. And that's where, as you were talking about, the works in India back that up. Terry's in Greenville, South Carolina. Go ahead, Terry.
Good morning, George.
Hi there.
Hey, listen, a couple of months ago, you had a guest on who was talking about unusual experiences that he had while he was traveling. And I want to tell you about a couple of synchronicities
sure.
that I had on a trip that I took out west a couple of years ago. I had visited the George Washington Carver National Historic Site near Joplin in Missouri, and I was just finishing up that visit, and I stopped at the front desk and spoke briefly with the rangers. I then started to walk to the door to head back to my car when I stopped briefly at the other end of the desk to take a quick look at some brochures. Well, another tourist walked up to the counter at that instant to talk with the rangers, and in the course of their conversation, which I couldn't help but overhear since I was just a few feet away, she told the rangers that she used to be a National Park Service park ranger herself at Appomattox in Virginia. Well, my uncle was a ranger there in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So I mentioned my uncle's name to her, and she said that she had worked with him at the end of his career and near the beginning of hers, and she confirmed to me that she had indeed known him when she said that he resembled Alfred Hitchcock, which he did. If I hadn't stopped at that exact moment when I did, I never would have heard her say Appomattox and never would have met her.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Super
story. And real quick, if I could, a couple days later, I was in La Junta, Colorado on a Saturday night, and I tried to look up a church on the internet to go to that Sunday morning, and I found one, La Junta Baptist Tabernacle, and just to make a long story short, when they found out I was from Greenville, South Carolina, they said, well, our pastor's wife is from Greenville, South Carolina. So got to talking to the pastor and his wife. And it turns out that I had been a member of the same church years ago as her parents.
Synchronicity at its best. Let's go to Wayne in Lexington, South Carolina.
Good evening, George Norrie.
Hello there, Wayne.
How are you, sir? I'm a very lucky man. Been around the world about 15 times doing environmental engineering. And I've seen a lot of cultures. And you there?
Yeah.
Okay. I've had quite a few experiences. I was on Guam when 9.2 earthquake. And sound was, it looked like ocean waves. And of course, you know, I was, it frightened me. I heard God, you know. And the ultimate, I guess, is just being able to sit here tonight and talk to you at my age and all you fellows are youngsters. And I'll be 75 my next birthday.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, and doing real well, work. And I think that's one of the keys. People forget how to do things. And technology today has almost ruined us, and then drug culture. But the one thing that is constant with me is the Creator. And you were commenting, and some of your guests were commenting on, you know, who does what and how things work. And what I found along the way is if you just let, and I'll say it again, if you just let God guide you, I think that 99% of the problems in the world will go away.
Well, that's probably true. We're coming back in a moment. Billy Carson joining us as we talk about UFOs.